Vice President Joe Biden is preparing maybe for the biggest speech of his life tonight as he formally accepts the Democratic Party's nomination for president during their national convention. This is after Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren addressed the convention last night, and California Senator Kamala Harris marked her historic ascension as the first Black woman and Asian American on a major party presidential ticket. So here to discuss what it all means for us in New England is Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Congresswoman Pressley, welcome back to Radio Boston. Congresswoman?
I'm here. Good to be with you.
Glad to have you. Thanks. You know, we have not spoken since Senator Harris was announced as Joe Biden's running mate. You are no stranger to firsts as an elected official, and I'm wondering how you're reflecting on this moment.
Sure. Well, neither is Senator Harris. You know, her personal life and certainly her entire public life have been a symbolic, representative, trailblazing first. And so this is just one more step in that regard. Last night I was watching her accept the nomination, watching her speech with my husband and our daughter, and he was braiding her hair, and it was an incredible moment. I think her speech really effectively gave tribute to the generations of women who came before her, whose dreams and ambitions she embodied. And honestly, I think her nomination is really long overdue recognition of the vital role that Black women have played, not only in the Democratic Party, but especially the most reliably voting constituency. Black women have been the table shakers, the truth tellers, the preservers of our democracy, and at the forefront of every social movement, including as we talk about the centennial for the ratification of the 19th Amendment, allies in that fight, even though Black women did not even have the right to vote until 55 years later after that. And so this really honors that. And Senator Harris and I have both spoken very often about the role our mothers have played in our lives, and so I knew that she would bring Shamla into the room, and she honored her mother with her conviction and the values that she placed center stage, the grace, all the things that her mother poured into her. And I think she demonstrated her allegiance to the highest ideals of this country and her commitment to do the work in pursuit of racial, economic, health care, just in the name of justice, period. The fact that she said we still have work to do for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. This is for having a Black woman that on the ticket, you know, at this level, who's been in proximity to these issues and can say unapologetically that Black lives matter. So it was
an historic day. Let's pick up on that for a moment, Congresswoman. Senator Harris, in her speech last night, spoke about the racial disparity and how people are affected by the coronavirus. Here she is.
Black, Latino, and Indigenous people are suffering and dying disproportionately. And this is not a coincidence. It is the effect of structural racism, of inequities in education and technology, healthcare and housing, job security and transportation. This virus, it has no eyes, and yet it knows exactly how we see each other.
We know these disparities exist here in Boston, and we know that the party ratified its platform earlier this week, even amid controversy that didn't move close enough to Medicare for All. And I want to ask you, are you satisfied that the national platform, as it now stands, represents the needs not only of the people in your district, but of the people of Massachusetts as a whole?
Well, there were many things that were reflected in the platform, that I think are representative of many of the progressive policies and changes that I've certainly been organizing for and fighting for. But on Medicare for All, I do believe it fell short, especially in the midst of a pandemic. But I want to be very clear in saying this, that the platform and the convention and not even Election Day, that is not a capstone or an ending, a bookend to our work. In many ways, it's just beginning. You know, the election of Vice President Biden and Senator Harris will really be more of a door than a destination. After that, it's going to be up to us to continue to challenge them, to partner with them, to organize, to mobilize, for this more equitable and just world. And as I've said oftentimes, in quoting Reverend Barber, we are in the midst of a national reckoning, and it does demand of us a third reconstruction. And that's the part that I'm committed to, is this rebuilding, so that when we are beyond this pandemic, that we are not returning to a normal that was insufficient, unjust, and inadequate to begin with.
You mentioned challenging and partnering with a future Biden-Harris administration, which is something that we saw between Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden, was the challenging and then the partnering. Last night, Senator Warren gave a convention speech where she used her reputation as the plans candidate to endorse Biden's policy. I want to play a bit of that for you.
Now, I love a good plan. And Joe Biden has some really good plans. Plans to bring back union jobs in manufacturing and create new union jobs in clean energy. Plans to increase Social Security benefits, cancel billions in student loan debt. These plans reflect a central truth. Our economic system has been rigged to give bailouts to billionaires and kick dirt in the face of everyone else.
So during the primary, Joe Biden got a lot of criticism, including from Elizabeth Warren, about not being progressive enough. And I believe it's part of the reason you endorsed Elizabeth Warren over the rest of the field. Has she now made her stamp on this ticket and its platform?
I think Elizabeth Warren has made her stamp on our country, on our democracy. And her remarks last night are exactly why I was so proud to endorsed her, to serve as one of her three national co-chairs, and why I'm proud that she's our senator. She showed the empathy, the compassion, and the strength that defined her as a candidate for president. And, you know, she spoke directly to me. I knew she was going to center policy. That's why I endorsed her for president. Policy is my love language, and she speaks to that. You know, the fact that she was centering this issue of child care and how critical it is to our infrastructure, period. But especially as we seek to recover from these conflated public health and economic crises as a result of this pandemic. She really does deeply understand the importance of intentional, inclusive policymaking to address the hurt and harm facing our communities. And so I think she effectively drove home the importance of doing the work to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, as well as the equal importance of remaining engaged after November 3rd. To stay in the fight, to continue to organize, to continue to advocate. And she got in that big structural change, you know. So as I said earlier, the work is on us. Their election is not the destination. It's simply a door.
There has been a lot of criticism of the DNC from the left of not giving enough space to young progressive voices like you, like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I want to ask yourself, do you see yourself, your constituents, your priorities represented in this convention?
Of course, I just want to acknowledge the very powerful and unifying message that Representative Ocasio-Cortez offered. So she made good of her 1 minute and delivered a unifying message that speaks to the strength of our movement. And our movement is not one that could fit on or be contained on a stage for a week. The movement is what is happening in communities. It's what's happening on these streets with the sustained moment of intolerance for injustice at all levels. So I'm encouraged by the strength of our movement. I do believe that with Senator Harris on this ticket, that we are going to see residual benefits when it comes to our regaining control of the Senate and growing our numbers and strengthening our majority in the House.
And that's Congresswoman.
So, you know, people, I just want to just, you know, people not being a part of a convention program in no way erases or minimizes the contributions of the work that that we've done and will continue to do, because ultimately that's how change is ushered in. It's through these movements.
Thank you, Congresswoman. That's Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Tiziana. Be well.
You too. In this week of so much politics, local, national, let's now turn to someone connected to all of it, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. It's a pleasure to have you. Governor, you ran for president this cycle in part because you said you felt the field wasn't gaining enough momentum in a critical election year. How are you feeling about the final ticket today?
Great, Tiziana. Terrific, for two reasons. One, I think that the very movement and the pressure that your previous guest, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, was talking about has had an impact on the platform and on the thinking of Joe Biden. I know that because I've spoken with him, and I think you've seen that in the way some of his policy agenda has become more ambitious than it was when he stepped out. And secondly, I think adding Kamala Harris to the ticket was masterful. She is a fierce advocate and a tireless and effective campaigner. And I think she too will push him. And I think that what we're seeing in the vice president is one of two really, really great personal qualities that I think make him the right candidate for the moment. One that we hear a lot about is his empathy, which is real and deep. But the second is that he listens. And we're at a time where there are a lot of strong opinions about how to address some big and chronic challenges facing our country. And the fact that his mind and his ears are open, I think, creates a real opportunity for all of us.
So let's stay on Vice President Biden for a minute. I was eager to talk to you about the convention because I want to think about what this race, this election season, means for us here in the Commonwealth specifically. Mm-hmm. And one of our colleagues here, Alex Ashlock, reminded us of when Joe Biden, when he was vice president, came to Boston 6 years ago for the mm-hmm. one-year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. And we yes. pulled a cut of the speech. I'd like to play it for you. He's at the Heinz Convention Center. It's April 15, 2014, and he's paying tribute to the victims, the injured, and people who responded to the scene. Here he is.
That's what Bostonians do. That's what Bostonians did. That's what the whole world saw. That's what America does. And next Monday, on Patriots Day, when I'm told up to 36,000 people line up to start the marathon, you will send a resounding message around the world, not just to the rest of the world, but to the terrorists, that we will never yield. We will never cower. America will never, ever, ever stand down. We are Boston. We are America. We respond. We endure. We overcome. And we own the finish line.
So much there, especially in a year where now we're actually not running the Boston Marathon this year. Yes. What's your reaction to hearing that again? And will we hear that Joe Biden tonight?
Well, I haven't previewed the speech, and I have to imagine that for all of the speakers, the idea of speaking direct to camera rather than in a hall where you're getting the feedback from the crowd has had some impact. But I will say, as a viewer, what I have loved about the convention, in addition to the fact that every possible type and kind of American has been represented, and it's been a beautiful, beautiful portrait of our country, has been that we have been able to focus really on the words and the ideas, and they've been quite compelling. And I think we'll see that from Joe Biden. He understands the gravity of the moment, not just because it is always a big deal to be formally accepting the nomination of a party and to have the prospect of becoming president, but because he is a servant leader, he understands that, and he understands that's what we particularly need right now. And that the healing is not going to be just kind of glossing over and getting back to what we used to do, which is a conversation he and I have had very pointedly. Much as I love Barack Obama, Barack Obama would tell you that going back to his time as president is not exactly what the country needs right now.
Of all the things that you talked to Joe Biden about, of all the things that you wanted to affect in your candidacy, what is most important that you see the Biden-Harris ticket carry forward?
Well, you know, we can talk about policy. I think he and I are probably quite aligned on how to take the ACA to the next level and how important it is to have a public option. I wouldn't be surprised if we find that that public option is Medicare for a host of reasons, but I don't want to forecast that. I'm purely speculating. I think that I'm hoping that the very first policy initiative that the new administration pushes, God willing, we have a new administration, is the reform of the democracy itself. The amount of money, the hyper partisan gerrymandering, the vote suppression, the purging, the various ways compounded now during this pandemic, that we have made it harder for people to participate and to get the government that they deserve. And I think doing that first, up to and including minimizing the impact and influence of lobbyists, makes a way for a fair competition of ideas across the rest of the policy platform.
And what could success in that mean for and in Massachusetts?
Well, look, you know, I think that, and I say this, you know, with a mixture of warmth and criticism, we have a pretty tight, inward-looking, hard-to-penetrate political establishment. The dynamic here is less Democrat-Republican than it is insider-outsider. And I think that there are more and more newcomers stepping up and competing. And I think that is a great thing, whether they win or lose, because I think folks need to feel that they aren't entitled to the jobs they hold in elective office, that they win, they earn the opportunity to serve if they serve. And that means not just listening to the powerful, it's listening to the meek as well, and finding ways to include all voices and all perspectives.
I want to continue to bring our focus here into the Commonwealth. In a couple minutes ago, we talked about Joe Biden's speech here after the Marathon bombing. You were governor for that crisis. We're in another very painful and difficult kind of crisis now. How do you feel about the state of our Commonwealth right now?
Well, I think that Governor Baker has a really, really tough job, as I do governors across the country, because, you know, being effectively told by the White House, you're on your own, you figure it out and call us if you need something, but we won't promise you that we'll respond to your call, is just an impossible way to deal with something which does not respect state lines. I think that that the governor and his team have been doing a really, really great job. I have said that I felt they were slow to start, but I think they've gotten their pace now, and they're modeling the importance of dealing with science and fact, and not taking undue risk. And I think they have earned the confidence and the trust of the electorate with respect to dealing with the pandemic. But it is so hard to deal with something like this within a state. You know, the Marathon bombing, we suspected and worked around and toward understanding whether there were connections beyond Massachusetts, certainly beyond Boston. And we had the resources to do that. But at the end of the day, we were dealing with an incident that was confined to Boston and affected people in the greater Boston area. We weren't having to deal with the incident itself crossing state lines, and that's materially different from what the governor and his team are having to deal with right now. So, you know, we are all wishing them well. It's just a terrible and difficult decision to try to think about, for example, what to do about kids going back to school. The kids want it, the parents want it, but everybody wants it to be safe. And it's just really hard to see quite how you do that. And as I say, especially hard to do it when we're not getting consistent guidance at the federal level.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. You know, we've been following that in depth here on Radio Boston, and it's been so painful for all the parties involved. We've talked to parents, teachers, superintendents, who all, I think, have great frustration, not only that there are only what seem to be bad options, but that centralized information and centralized standards could have made more difference. Does the state, you've talked about the federal need for that. Does the state have a role in that? And how do you strike the balance between mandates and freedom of choice and movement for districts in such a tough situation?
Well, you know, and part of it that makes it tough, I shouldn't laugh, but it's just from our experiences, grandparents of a seven-year-old, you know, homeschooling is no joke. It is hard. You know, if there are silver linings to some of this, I hope more folks are respecting and honoring what teachers do day in and day out. It's magical. And it's enabling, of course, especially for working parents. I think, you know, this notion of centralized mandates versus individual freedom, it's a luxury to be able to talk about this sort of thing in the abstract. There is a responsibility that makes freedom possible. Freedom to me is not just being able to do whatever you want to whomever you want because you feel like it. It is understanding the responsibility you have as a member of a free community. And if we are to have an enduring community, then we're going to have to think about our stake and our impact on each other. And I think that is what makes the need for having at least a common understanding of the challenge and common guidelines useful. Now, how people adapt those guidelines to their individual situations, the individual schools and classrooms and families, there's a lot of room for that, a lot of room for creativity. But having the guidelines uniform seems to me a service that the government owes us right now.
Well, the clock in the background reminds me of our clock, too. I'd love to keep
talking
to you.
I'm sorry about
that. That's all right. It was a treat to talk to you. That's former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. I sure appreciate your time today.
Thank you for yours, Tiziana. Be well.
Crane Beach has lost 84 football fields worth of sand to erosion since the 1950s. This according to a new report from conservation group, the Trustees of Reservations, which sounds the alarm on how climate change is affecting Massachusetts' North Shore, from increased tidal flooding to beach erosion. WBUR environmental editor Barbara Moran has been digging into the report's finding, joins us now to tell us about it. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Tiziana. How you doing?
Great to talk to you. What are the key findings of this report, Barbara?
So the report is really interesting. It looked at 13 communities on the North Shore and really taking a deep dive into climate change risks in those communities, like sea level rise, storm surge flooding, and even beach erosion, like you mentioned. One example of that is Crane Beach. And as you said, it's like 112 acres have eroded from Crane Beach since the 1950s, which seems kind of incredible. And this morning I spoke to Tom O'Shea with the trustees. He's the director of Coast and Natural Resources. And he said those kind of stats make you wonder, like, how much longer is there's going to be a beach there, right? But even in the short term, they're already having issues with even the road getting into the beach, right? So here's Tom O'Shea talking about that.
Sea level rise is starting to flood the road, the one way into Crane Beach, a few times every month now, and it's looking like it could become almost daily after 2030. So that means 350,000 people who want to get to Crane Beach, and they're not going to drive through a flooded roadway two times a day.
So that is alarming. What do we know about the impacts on surrounding communities, economically, physically, otherwise?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the report said that about 600 buildings on the North Shore are at risk of flooding every day by 2030. And by 2070, that number jumps to more than 3,000 buildings at risk of flooding every single day. So you can imagine all the real estate on the coast up on the North Shore, and that just puts billions of dollars of real estate at risk. And also, it's not just the money, there's a lot of really critical infrastructure and really sort of well-known tourist hotspots. And here's Tom O'Shea talking about that again.
Salem stood out to me because there were some real areas in the future along their built waterfront, even the Salem State Campus, where there's likely to be some storm flooding. Newbury Waterfront, everybody loves to go down to the Newbury Waterfront. Beautiful area, right, with restaurants and shops downtown. And, you know, they're seeing, you know, real risks from storm surge from going up through the Merrimack River.
Barbara, I want to ask, this is a conservation group with a significant set of land holdings in the area, an advocacy agenda. So just checking, is this a worst case scenario picture that they're painting, or are these numbers fairly middle of the road, so to speak?
That is a great question, Tiziana, and always a good question
Thank
to
you.
Ask. And they do explain that in the report. And they worked with consultants called the Woods Hole Group. And what they did was they used what they call the business as usual estimates for sea level rise, meaning these are the estimates that we would expect to see if greenhouse gas emissions continue along as they are now. So they could end up lower, potentially. But, you know, I talk to climate scientists a lot, and pretty much they're saying that's a reasonable way to go. And so the estimates are seen as fairly reasonable.
So while we have you, I also want to ask you, Barbara, about Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu's city level Green New Deal. Kind of what's in it and how does it compare to national efforts like, you know, Senator Ed Markey and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's? How does it compare also or build upon Mayor Walsh's existing climate goals for Boston?
Yeah. So, Michelle Wu proposed this really interesting sort of localized version of the Green New Deal. And in some ways, it dovetails the national and state and Mayor Walsh's efforts. You know, it's looking at things like renewable energy and how we're going to decarbonize the city, how we're going to deal with stormwater and transportation, how we'll use urban trees to deal with hotspots. So everybody's kind of on the same page and talking about the same things. Some of the details are different, like how fast we do things. Wu also proposes free transit, free public transit, which is, you know, more contentious among some people. But overall, I feel like it's these sort of ambitious goals that a lot of people are talking about. And what else I liked about Wu's proposal is that she folds in issues of green jobs and environmental justice and structural racism and all these things that really need to be addressed along with the climate change issues.
So on the pandemic, Barbara, some climate activists and environmentalists have been noting kind of how our response to the coronavirus has lessons for how we respond to climate change. How have you been thinking about that?
Right. So all the climate change folks are sort of scratching their heads and thinking about how do we, you know, if we can get people to take drastic action in their lives, this idea of bending the curve, right? Bending the mm-hmm. curve to get the number of cases down, right? Is there a way to make people think about bending the curve on climate change? That if you act early, you can avert the worst causes. So I feel like our reaction to the pandemic in a way has given climate people who think about climate change, giving them hope that sort of real change is possible and real change is possible to happen really quickly. But they're kind of hoping that we can make climate change decisions not in panic mode, right? Like we can do things mm-hmm. now instead of waiting till there's, you know, a disaster staring us right in the face.
Well, that's Barbara Moran, editor of WBUR's environmental team. We're going to continue to watch this with you. Barbara, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tiziana.
It has been a weird summer, and everything still feels like it's changing every day. The chaos has been reflected in our music, where the number one Billboard slot has felt like a rotating door of hits.
I'm a savage, yeah. Classy, bougie, ratchet, yeah. Sassy, moody, hey. Nasty, hey. Yeah. Stupid, what was happening?
Ooh, I'm blinded by the lights. No, I can sleep until I feel your touch. Watermelon sugar high.
So that's Megan Thee Stallion Savage, The Weeknd's Blinding Light, and Harry Styles' Watermelon Sugar. To talk about finding summer's great song in a season of chaos, we have two guests. We have Tim Riley, a music critic with NPR and associate professor at Emerson College. Tim, welcome.
Hi there.
Also, we have Prince Charles Alexander, an acclaimed recording and mixing engineer who's worked with the likes of Mary J. Blige, Destiny's Child, Notorious B.I.G., Aretha Franklin. He's also a performing artist in the 1980s and now teaches at the Berklee College of Music. Welcome, PC.
Welcome. This is actually my home, Boston. So, you know, I've been around BUR all my life. This is really a great opportunity.
What's a treat to have you. And listeners, we want to ask you, what is your song of the summer, or maybe songs, because it feels like, you know, there's a lot going on. You might want different feels on different days. How have your listening habits changed? Call us with all of it, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And as we dive into this, young listeners, parents who may be listening to this, I do want to give you a heads up. Some of the songs we will talk about do touch on adult themes today. So heads up about that. PC, I'll start with you. It has been a weird summer. How has that been reflected in the music people are listening to?
Yeah, we're kind of all over the place. You know, hip-hop started to dominate pop music in 27. Officially, it became the number one genre. And hip-hop has a polyrhythmic thing that it does with tempo. You can have something that's at 90 beats per minute, but you can program it at 180. So you could either, you could look at the song in either one of those ways. Prior to probably 2018, popular music was either at 120 where you were dancing or 90 where you were kind of like cooled out and chill in the summer. And we actually started to slow down from 120 into the 90s as we went from into 2014, 15 all up to 2020. And then around 17, hip hop really took over and gave us this multiplicity of tempos. So I'm not sure whether people dance to music or sip margaritas to music or what these days, but I know that we're all over the place and there's always been a breakout hit every summer. This summer feels strange.
So Tim, you know, May to mid-June, there were six different songs that took the number one spot in 6 weeks. It's the first time there's been kind of that level of movement at the chart's top position since 1990. Last year, we know there was kind of a coalescing around Old Town Road, which was an undeniable hit. But this year, nothing seems to be sticking that way. Why do you think that is?
Well, you take, I mean, the music business has been in great flux the past few years, so it's tectonic plates of how music is produced and consumed keep shifting. Then you throw COVID quarantine on top of that. So yeah, it's, you know, it's crazy. It's a crazy time and you're throwing in extra crazy. What's fun about this summer is that Megan Thee Stallion was actually had the hit to beat with Savage, which was already like a pretty dominant, you know, and it looked like it was going to be the song of the summer. And then she actually outdid herself by coming out with this WAP song. And it's, you know, that's really something when somebody's actually got a soaring hit and they actually outdo themselves. I really like what PC was saying about how I think the tempo to the WAP song is actually slower.
Yeah.
Okay.
WAP.
So let's talk.
Let
me set this up for our listeners a little bit because, okay. So WAP, to be clear, we can't play it. We can't quote it. We can't tell you what it stands for, but we will say it's a song from Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion that is all about female sexual pleasure. And it has taken hold in the last, you know, little while here. So PC, go ahead.
So I was going to say that WAP is doing what many of us do in the music business. We, you know, we borrow on successful themes. Old Town Road was at a slowed down 68 halftime, which is 136 double time. WAP is at 68 halftime, 136 double time. So, you know, just be trying to be successful in 2020 and doing that nod back to 2019, it looks like Cardi and her team looked at Old Town Road, at its success, and tried to manufacture a summer hit. And I think they did an excellent job.
So I'm struck by you saying that because the beats per minute is not what people are really talking about with that song.
No.
And I do wonder, I mean, it is rattling cages. And Tim, PC, I'll ask you both. How big of a deal is that? It's not the first time we've had women talking about their sexuality, but there is something different here, and it is raw. What does that say about women in music, women rappers, the summer of 2020? Tim, why don't you go first?
Well, you know, it seems old hat to me, but I've been watching pop music for a long time. But anytime a big famous female star aggressively announces her sexuality or desire, that outrages a lot of people. But people always freak out about that. They freaked out about it with Tina Turner. They freaked out about it with Madonna. They freaked out about it with Lady Gaga. It's kind of it's on a loop, right? And it's a surefire way. It's an aspect of the song that I think is kind of lessens it, is it's kind of a novelty. You know, it's kind of like, it's like twerking, right? It just is a rehash of the old twerking thing.
Twerking being a controversy that weirdly Miley Cyrus wound up bringing to the American people a couple of summers ago.
Four or five years ago, which is very physically explicit. And this is very lyrically explicit, but you know, it's why do we call it explicit? Men do it and we don't call it explicit. It's only explicit when females do it.
So, let me weigh in on that because, you know, the Ying Yang Twins had a song called The Whisper Song, which was pretty explicit. Two Live Crew in the 80s were doing some really radical stuff also. This is not new. What is a little bit different is the accessibility that Cardi has as a popular icon. She is granted something that the Ying Yang Twins didn't have. Even Luther Campbell, like, I knew about the Two Live Crew's music, but you had to go find it. I don't have to go find WAP. It's in my face because I'm studying popular music all the time. That's very different. Male or female, you know, the sexuality aside, the fact that she is an accessible artist and is now taking this adult-themed composition to the top of the charts is a radical departure. And for me, as a parent that has a 9-year-old daughter, I don't think I've played pop music in my car for my daughter yet, but if I do, that song might pop on, and now I'm going to be thrust into a conversation I might not have wanted to have with my daughter at this moment. So it there's a piece of my parenting that I've got to be even hyper vigilant now, because the popular music charts are throwing something at all of us and, you know, starting some conversations.
I'd like to go to the phones here because they are blowing up. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Yuna on the line from Brighton. Yuna, go ahead.
Hi. So I just wanted to say what a big role I think social media plays in what songs are popular nowadays, because I'm in my 20s. I don't really listen to the radio anymore. So the only way I discover new music is basically through Instagram and TikTok. And I feel like the songs that blow up now are songs that have really popular TikTok dances, because that's what I see on my feed over and over and over again. So, like, in particular for Megan Thee Stallion, the reason Savage is such a huge song was because there's this dance that, like, everybody on TikTok was trying to do.
Thanks for that, Yuna. So let me bring it back, and I'm going to play a little bit more of Savage for us, and then let's talk about that, about how social media, maybe more than the Billboard charts right now, are the king and queen makers. Here's Savage.
I'm a savage. Classy, bougie, ratchet. Sassy, moody, nasty.
Okay, so I gotta admit, that is an earworm of a song, and if you've watched the dance, it kind of makes you want to try. So what is it, especially when you're not hearing songs ubiquitously in outdoor radios, at restaurants, in malls, what is social media doing to how we're experiencing what a great song is and how we converge on a song of the summer, Tim?
Well, so what's really fun is to think of that the dance craze is sort of making a comeback through TikTok and these other things. It used to, you know, in the early 60s, dance crazes really were they were the driver. And we haven't seen this in a long, long time. So it's sort of nostalgic to see it happening again. And TikTok has sort of made dance routines and funny dance moves like a different kind of eye candy, right? They're really just fun to watch. You go down these rabbit holes watching all these people do these cool moves.
PC, social media is much more fractured than when we, you know, hearing a song in a stadium, for example, when you're all there for a sporting event. Can we have the kind of summer convergence around a single song when social media is driving what we're hearing and consuming?
We can, and I actually think that WAP might be that song, which is a little bit scary. prior to WAP, it did feel fractured to me in 2020. But that song might be doing something. But, you know, we still there's still a few more weeks left, and there won't be a 19-week composition like Old Town Road. That's clear. But there might be, WAP might lead us into the fall. I'm still, you know, I'm still checking this one out.
Still waiting to see. All right, let's go back to the phones. We'll take a few calls here, 800-423-8255. Randy in Somerville, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to build on the fact of where we get our songs. My summer jam has been When the Morning Comes from Hall & Oates, and I got that at the end of the movie Palm Springs on Hulu. And it has just a beautiful vocal harmony, and it's about a sort of a soothing balm to sort of the daily set of traumas that are seem to be inflicted. And it's like, maybe tomorrow will be better.
Well, that sounds great, Randy. Thank you for that. And we've got Jonathan from Cambridge. Jonathan, go ahead.
Hi. Another song about female empowerment is Ferris Wheel by Sylvanesso. It's got great earworms and a fantastic dance beat.
Thanks, Jonathan. And let's take one more. Let's take Pierce from Jamaica Plain.
Hello. So first of all, I just wanted to completely agree with the first caller. I know there's been a little bit of back and forth about that. But like all music, I'm 19 years old, and all music for my generation, like the top hits, all come from TikTok now. But in terms of the music I've been listening to this summer, I've been taking it back to a lot of oldies music, the Eagles, Doobie Brothers, Billy Joel, James Taylor, all that kind of stuff.
Going old school, Pierce. All right. So what I heard, I mean, it makes me want to hear every single one of those songs right now from all the callers. But Tim and PC, what are we hungering for in the music that we're turning to right now? PC.
So that's why I started off with tempo, because there's a danceability. There's a movement factor. I won't even call it danceability, but a movement, a choreograph factor that's going on with this TikTok scene, because Old Town Road was successful on TikTok also. Of course, Savage, of course, WAP has been parodied. I even saw a young lady that did Waffles and Pancakes as her kids bop version of WAP, and I thought that was kind of cute. But there is a movability, a danceability. And there is something about, for me, studying the rhythms of these compositions and how it plays into body movement that is kind of even goes all the way back to Michael Jackson, that I feel the visual aspect that started in 1980 with MTV now lives in TikTok. And it's like these very, very short 30-second sound bites. And it's the culmination of where we've been trying to go with our technology for for many, many decades now.
Yeah, and Tim, what do you think? Yeah, go.
I agree with all that, and I think there's also the cocktail for the summer single has always been this combination of romance and escapism, and like equating the free for all joy of summer, the liberation of summer, "School's Out" by Alice Cooper, right, or "Good Vibrations" by the Beach Boys. It's always been linked to romance. It's that heady feeling of romance, and when you have a summer romance, that's when you hit the bullseye. But what's interesting about WAP and even Savage is that these are not romance songs. These are just pure escapist songs, right? Mm. And I think that really we're tilting towards the escapist fantasies being quarantined, which makes a lot of sense.
So one of the things that I wanted to ask each of you was if you could go sort of anywhere in time and ask an artist to make the song of this summer, who do you wish you could hear from right now, PC?
I think it would be Marvin Gaye, because Marvin Gaye is the consummate vocalist and the consummate music producer. And it would probably be sexy, though. it would probably be as adult-themed as WAP, but, mm-hmm. you know, he would bring it. He would bring it.
How about you, Tim?
I think one of the great summer singles is Bruce Springsteen's Girls in Their Summer Clothes. And I think that was a very sort of self-conscious pitch at like, I want to write a summer single for myself. And I think he really nailed it with that. He's also been putting together these radio shows that everyone started listening to. So he's doing it in a different kind of way. And it's, again, he's blending a sort of romance, the idea of like music brings us comfort, it nourishes us, and also escapism. Like we need to get out. We need to get into our minds and escape this dull daily reality we're all trapped in.
So, PC, I want to come back to Marvin Gaye for a minute. I'm going to play a portion here of his 1971 song, What's Going On.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, brother, brother.
Okay, in truth, I really just want to play that song through the end of the show. We can all sit and listen together. But, you know, we are in the middle of a pandemic. We are in the middle of a massive reckoning on race. And none of the songs really that we've been talking about that are out this summer that have caught on are anthems of our moment. Why do you think that is, PC?
That's a great question, and it's something I've been pondering. I think it has to do with the corporatization of our industry. And, you know, there's also a little bit of not really knowing where the revenue is coming from. We know that streaming is generating something. We know that sales are generating something. And we know that radio play, even though people are not into radio, radio is still a big driver of advertising. The corporate model has just changed the way that artists access the large distribution that record labels grant them. And is it being perverted? And by whom are the questions I'm always asking myself? Are the artists saying, please let me do something profane and pornographic? Or are the labels saying, you know, the more of a car accident it looks like, the more traction we get with likes. So maybe we need to move over into this other lane where things are kind of crazy looking, and never mind any of that empowerment stuff and any of that dealing with sociology stuff. Let's just deal with all these destroyed concepts. You know, it's something that I'm thinking about all the time. And, you know, I have this saying, follow the cheese. The mice are following the cheese, and the cheese is the money. So there's a lot behind that.
So, Tim, in our last, you know, 30 seconds or so, I'll just give you a chance to build on or respond to that.
All right. So there is this really wonderful remix that a guy named I. Marquis did of a Cardi B track, and it's called Coronavirus. So part of the problem is getting this stuff turned around really, you know, quickly. And the other song I thought might take off is Mickey Guyton's Black Like Me, which was done before the virus hit and the protest, but is still really just a giant bullseye and would have made a great ballad summer single.
All right, that's Tim Riley, music critic with NPR and associate professor at Emerson, and Prince Charles Alexander, an acclaimed recording and mixing engineer, now teaching at Berklee College of Music. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.